Good morning to you all. It's a pleasure to see so many people gathered here for this one-day symposium in which we will be addressing issues in contemporary archiving in the digital age. But before we get down to all that, I'd like to start with a definition. In the context of today's event, what do we mean by digital, and what is the digital age? After all, the British Library has been digitising its sound collections for more than 30 years. Back in the early 1980s, that process of digitisation would have involved one of those. That's a Betamax cassette, for those of us too young to remember them the first time round. And if it was the 1980s and I had one of those Betamax cassettes with the right equipment, I could record 90 minutes of CD quality digital audio on that. And if I had the right equipment, store it, play it back. Around the same time, the library accessioned its first one of these. That is CD number one in the British Library's collections, Triumph by the Jacksons. We set the bar pretty high with that. And the first in a collection, as Andy says, now extending to several hundred thousand audio CDs. So, Betamax tapes, audio CDs, but would we consider the 1980s as part of the digital age? In the context of today's topic, I would have to say no. What defines our digital age is the way in which we interact with recorded media, not physically through items like these, but intangibly through streams of data delivered from file-based digital storage to connected devices when and how and where we like. This idea of the digital age then makes a clear distinction between physical media and digital content. And that separation of the physical from the digital, of what was from what is, does two things. Firstly, it makes us reconsider the purpose and the fragility of physical media. In light of today's technologies and the movement of industry and of consumers away from traditional formats, we are forced to question how long our physical collections will last and how we can go on providing access to them. Secondly, it makes us consider and to become aware of the benefits of our new digital environments. So take instant online access, for example. If I was that way inclined, I could take out my phone, open my streaming application of choice, and listen to Triumph or any number of Jackson's albums. But more than enabling that instant access, today's digital technologies have presented us with a means to provide sustainable access through the processes of digitization and digital preservation. And that's really what I want to talk about this morning. How, in this digital age of ours, can we approach the preservation of our recorded heritage, and what must we do to prevent its loss? So, in the context of what we at the BL get up to, let's have a look at those questions now. The library has long been aware of the threats faced by its sound collections and has undertaken a considered programme of appraisal and selection and migration from endangered physical media to more stable, high-quality formats. And we've done that for many years. Now, years ago, that would have meant migrating to something like a quarter-inch open-reel tape. And more recently, as we've seen, digital audio on Betamax cassettes, VHS cassettes, DATs, CDRs, and so on and so on, moving with technology as it develops. And while we've been very diligent in our work, it is by no means complete. It's estimated that currently we have digitally preserved, that is to digital files, between 2 and 3% of the British Library's sound collections. In those cases where we have migrated to physical media, the formats onto which those recordings have been migrated are now themselves at risk. Today, however, the technologies that support audio preservation are such that this process of migration can be done more efficiently, more cheaply, and at a better quality than ever before. And the BL is approaching this positively. We see this situation as both a risk, but also an opportunity. We understand that our sound collections are facing an immediate threat, but we also recognise that digitisation can provide a means to both instant and sustainable access, bringing our collections to a much wider audience for a much longer time. In order to help us achieve this, the Library is just in the process of completing a 12-month scoping study project, looking at the Library's current approaches to audiovisual preservation, including everything from selection to description, through digitization and ingest. And the outcome of this project will be a series of recommendations in a document on how best to ensure the digital preservation of the entirety of the BL's audiovisual collections within the next 15 years. Now, that's not a figure that we've pulled out of a hat. There is consensus internationally that we, as archivists, have a 10 to 20 year window of opportunity in which to migrate the contents of our physical sound collections to stable digital files. After this point, after the end of this 10 to 20 year window, general consensus is that the risks faced by physical media mean that migration will either become impossible, or partial, or just too expensive. So, in order to responsibly manage our collections, we have to identify what we have. We have to quantify our collections, know how many things we have. We must understand the risks that they face, and then use these statistics and this analysis to inform a prioritised and timely approach to the preservation of our physical collections. And after several months of analysis, including a lot of counting of items on shelves and searching databases and catalogues and drawing together an awful lot of information, I can comfortably tell you that the British Library holds around 5 million unique sound recordings in its collections. That's recordings that are different from one another. That these recordings are held on a little over 1.7 million different physical carriers. That's our things on shelves. And that these carriers are comprised of more than 40 different audio formats. So great, we've got some statistics, we've got some figures, that helps. And I've spoken a lot about risk, but what are the drivers behind the preservation of sound collections, and how does this idea of risk management influence what we, as responsible archivists, must do? Now, there are two key things that inform our approach to risk management and to the preservation of sound collections. And the first of these is what we would term physical degradation. And there's a great example of it in action here. Would anyone like to hazard a guess at what that is a picture of? It is an acetate. Good. It's an acetate disc or a lacquer disc, call it what you like. A means of recording sound information instantaneously onto a physical medium. A historical format, first appearing around 1934, but still used today. Works in exactly the same way as a vinyl LP might, but faces a far greater threat. I have one here, a blank one. Lacquer discs are generally composed of a substrate, usually of metal, which this one is, but sometimes glass or card, coated in a thin layer of lacquer, which in this case is cellulose nitrate. And we know from experience that this thin lacquer layer on our disc is prone to shrinking over time, while the more sturdy metal substrate isn't. So, over time, our lacquer surface, the bit with the recording on it, will crack and it will flake, and eventually the recorded information will become lost. And that's exactly what we're seeing here. So the light grey areas in the picture there are the metal substrate of the disc showing through, showing where the lacquer, the recording, has disappeared, and the grey-brown areas are what's left. So, lacquer discs, a prime example of where the inherent fragility of a physical format will lead to its eventual degradation, and that degradation will lead to loss. And that's driver number one behind our approach to preservation planning. Because of their fragility, lacquer discs are considered a high priority for preservation. Driver number two is slightly less obvious, and what we will term technical obsolescence. I'm not going to ask you what that is. Hopefully you all know that's a CDR. And CDRs are a good example of a format in the process of becoming threatened by obsolescence. So, for example, I know that I could take my CDR to a PC, I could pop it in a drive and play it or rip its contents to a digital file. But I also know that sales of optical media are declining, just as sales of digital media, that's digital files, are increasing. And with that decline in sales comes a decline in the availability of compatible hardware. If no one wants the things, why make the equipment to play them back? To the point at which it will become difficult and eventually impossible to extract the information from this disk. And that's driver number two. The obsolescence of a format leading to inaccessibility of content, and that, in turn, leading to loss. Now, it's worth pointing out that these two things aren't mutually exclusive. Our CDR, for example, might be prone to degradation as much as it is obsolescence. So we must be aware of the severity of each risk and to plan accordingly. So, we have a collection of sound recordings. We've quantified its extent. We know how many things we have on shelves. And we've identified what formats we have in our collections, and we've measured these two risks per format against one another. But how can we plan for their preservation? What stages do we need to go through to migrate the contents of our physical sound collections to a stable digital archive? That's a very big question, and one that I could probably talk about all day, but since it's before 11 o'clock, I'm going to condense the answer into seven very simple steps. And if you have any questions on these specifically, perhaps you can ask them at the end or call me afterwards. Step number one, first of all, we must select what items we need to preserve. Now, that might be as simple as just preserving everything, taking a blanket approach to preservation. Or it could be more complex. So if, for instance, we had two identical copies of our Jackson's album, do we need to preserve both, or just the better one of the two? And what if we have a copy on vinyl and one on CD? Do we consider both to be unique and preserve both, or only preserve one, the one we consider the better copy? So selection, or indeed deselection, the first key stage in preservation planning. Step number two. We must ensure that our physical carrier, our CD, our LP, whatever it is adequately described. Good old metadata. Metadata does two things. It enables us to associate the digital files that we're going to make with a record of the carrier that they came from, and it will enable the public to discover and to access that content digitally. So if I have a catalogue record for my album, and that record is associated with a digital file, my user can both discover that album and access it in one fell swoop. So description, metadata supports nice, integrated preservation and access. So we've selected what we're going to preserve. We've described the items that we've selected. Step number three is the important bit. We migrate the contents of our carrier to a lossless, high-resolution digital file, and we do this as accurately and as efficiently as possible. Ideally, this will be done by a trained engineer with experience in handling legacy media and carried out using equipment that is as professional and as state-of-the-art as we can get our hands on. We want to do this once, and we want to do it right. At the BL, this is something we aim to do in-house where possible. So we have 10 transfer studios in our Centre for Conservation, which are kept busy full-time with engineers working on audio preservation and outputting many hundreds of files per week. So, migration. Description, again, metadata, more metadata. We will describe the file that we've just created, how and when we made it, what equipment was used, and what settings were used to configure that equipment. And we might also record the characteristics of the file itself. Nice, detailed metadata about the provenance of our digital copy, which can be used in future to inform preservation systems or our future selves about where things came from and how to go about ensuring their preservation in future. Step number five. We're going to check that our files and our metadata are of suitable quality for preservation. The most boring step in our seven steps, but ultimately a very important part of any preservation program. This means quality checking our digital transfer and checking the accuracy of its metadata against a set of agreed standards. We want to know that what we've created is good enough to go into our long-term storage and to keep it there, and good enough for the public to access it and use it usefully. Number six. So, we've selected our items for transfer, we've described them, we've taken those items and we've migrated our contents to digital files, and we've created metadata describing those files, and we've checked that our files and all of our metadata are accurate. If we've done all that and we're happy with it, then we can go ahead and ingest our content and our metadata to a suitable, trusted digital repository. Now, for the library, that means our digital library system, or DLS. It is aimed to store all of the library's digital content here, not just our sound collections, but our digitized books, manuscripts, maps, everything. And there's one of those in London, but it's also mirrored at sites in Yorkshire and Edinburgh and Wales, which means that if London disappears, the nation's digital heritage is still safe. Number seven, we store the products of our digitization for future generations. And this last point is very important. And in effect, it takes us right back to the start. Because preservation doesn't have an endpoint. While digitization and digital technologies present us with an efficient and cost-effective and high-quality means of storing our sound collections, the products, the outputs of our digitization work, will face many of the same threats as their physical originals. Once our collections are migrated to digital files, we must ensure that these files remain both healthy and accessible in future. And that involves the same processes of managing obsolescence, in this case of file formats, and the physical health of digital storage. in just the same way as we manage the risks to our physical collections. And we must migrate when and where needed to ensure long-term access. So, there we are. Our digital age presents us with risks, yes, but equally with opportunities. If we are aware of the threats to our physical collections, and if we know what must be done in order to stabilize them, we can plan for their preservation. And if we are aware that this process of preservation must be ongoing, even in our digital age, then we can ensure sustainable access to our sound collections for future generations. Thank you. I hope that wasn't too gloomy a start to the day. I know other people have got far more exciting things to talk about. I'll invite any questions, will I? Yes, I will. I'll invite any questions that anyone might have.
Mm.
Yep.
I was potentially looking at the point of archiving some gaps here. I was told that they would be migrating and transferred at faster than normal speed.
Yes.
So it would take longer to check than to migrate.
It's an interesting situation with DATs and other media. So DATs are a good example, and CDs and CDRs are a good example of where we can use technology today to transfer things in faster than real time, as you say. So in the instance of your DATs, we might use some modified DDS drives to rip the bitstream from that DAT. But also the equipment, the software we use, and the hardware will talk to one another and produce an objective readout on errors encountered during a ripping process. And that can massively aid the checking process. So let's say if I was had an engineer transferring a compact cassette, the checking process for that would be quite lengthy and quite subjective. We'd need an engineer who knew what they were looking out for. They'd have to look and check against the original media that the azimuth was set okay, that noise reduction was correct, that the levels were all right, etc. If we've got something that spits out XML with objective readings from the transfer process, brilliant. We can use automated systems to interrogate that objective metadata and to pick out all of those files which have failed migration. So in the case of your DATs, the actual checking process takes far less time than it would a human checking process with a compact cassette.
Does that?
It might be aided by a human, but certainly the first point of interrogation would be automated error checking based on objective readouts. Where we can do that, yes. So all about efficiency and the best possible quality. So a computer's going to pick up errors better than I'm going to. Yes, for those particular formats. Yeah.
I've got two questions. The first is, by my calculation, you'd be digitising about 5,000 tracks of files a week, and you said you do many hundreds.
Yep.
So are you on track to do it?
No.
quick answer to that. The other question is, you mentioned, because you had the example of the Jacksons, this is the British Library. Obviously, yep. There's a great deal of British music. There's also music from abroad. Are there libraries in other parts of the world that are digitising their content, and can you share it, or is it something that just the British Library is doing?
You've hit the nail on the head. So, two questions. Firstly, no, we're not on schedule. In fact, at the current rate of digitisation, we estimate that it will take about 48 years to migrate all of our collections to stable digital files, and that's part of what our scoping study is about, looking at our options. What on earth are we going to do? And certainly that will involve some money from somewhere, which we don't have. So this is our first stage in planning for the next 15 years. Let's look at options. Let's see how we can get things done quicker. And that will probably involve outsourcing to someone. Secondly, yes. So the process of selection and deselection that I mentioned shouldn't just be confined to our own collections. We should look to see what other people are doing. Yes. Other people will have the Jacksons album, probably, I would hope. But a good example of where we do have significant overlap in our collections is with the BBC. So the BBC have been doing a lot of digitisation work over the past few years, And that will include material that we also hold copies of. So do we need to do the same thing as our partner institution is doing over at the BBC? Probably not. So there needs to be a more structured approach to looking at what we have, looking at items in our catalogues, and working out if a suitable digital copy exists elsewhere. Obviously, if it's another institution internationally and they've digitised our Jackson's album, that's great. What we probably can't do is provide access to that digital copy here. So we've got to consider, yes, it might have been preserved, but, you know, can we provide access to it from our premises? Does that answer your question? Good.
Thanks. In light of it's going to take 48 years to digitise all your content, yep. Are you looking at things like crowdsourcing?
Mm.
Things like the Smithsonian are putting their materials out there and the crowd are helping to digitise or provide metadata. Is that something you're looking at, or is that...?
Certainly for metadata, yes. We're quite picky about the quality of the stuff that we produce and that we ingest in terms of digital files, and we like to maintain quality. So we'd be a little bit wary about crowdsourcing that sort of digitization work. But metadata, yes, absolutely. We would love to be able to put things out there and to say, please fill in these catalogue fields for us, because that's a bulk of the cost of actually doing this work, getting people to sit down and type. The trouble with that is all of the rights issues associated with sound recordings. We could do that with some of our collections, the things that are out of copyright, or that we can clear the copyright on, which is probably not many. So our opportunities for crowdsourcing metadata are going to be quite limited. But it's certainly something that our scoping study is looking into. If we could do that in some way, that would be fantastic. Is that okay?
Well, it's not okay. You've got a problem with that.
No, it's not okay. Hello.
Hi. This is a question about quality. Mm. You showed an acetate earlier. Let's say you've got a really, really rubbish-sounding source, some speech, an interview that's on an acetate.
Mm-hmm.
And you talked about you're making objective copies of the things. You're making a digital copy.
Yep.
That is pretty much a clone of what would be heard off that acetate.
Yes.
And your objective here is also to make these things publicly accessible.
It is.
Now, if it's rubbish sounding in the first place and you make a rubbish sounding copy through no fault of your own, what sort of mastering process are you doing to make these things more friendly,
more palatable
to the ears of the public? Are you, I mean, is this just a, this is it, we've made a digital copy of the same thing, or do you have the time, resources to do any sort of mastering process to make these things listenable?
There's a big danger there, that if we started going about subjectively restoring things, which is what you're talking about, is that meeting the needs of our users? And how relevant will those subjective restorations be in future? So I could take my acetate, make an awful copy of it, and I could use today's technology to do some de-clicking, some denoising, and I could store a version of that, not the same as our untouched warts and all version in our digital library system. And yes, that might make it more palatable for a researcher. In the future, our subjective restoration of that might not be as good as we could get it with future technologies. So is it worth doing it now? And secondly, there are dangers in using that sort of technology to reduce unwanted bits from signals. So I'm looking at our wildlife curator here and thinking about denoising on something like a recording of birdsong. That's going to mess up the sonogram from that recording, and that's going to influence how that recording might be used by a researcher. We certainly do a bit of restoration. So if anyone's been on our BL Sounds website, pretty much all of the recordings on there will have undergone some sort of restoration process. But that's more of a gallery, if you like, a public gallery, curated collections, yes, useful to researchers and also nice for the public, and it's our public facing way to get at our sound collections. And yes, we have done some restoration on those in the past, but I think in the future, if we're going to go ahead and migrate the contents of our 1.76 million carriers, then doing that sort of restoration work is far beyond our means. Does that answer your question? Good. One
more.
Yep, last one.
Hi. Question is, there's an argument that some content needs to be lost.
Are we talking about the Jacksons again?
Possibly.
There is indeed an argument that some content might be lost, might better be lost. We assume that if it's in our collections, that there has been a process of selection of that item for acquisition. And because that item has been selected and acquired and stored, then we have a remit to preserve it. So I think that's our main approach. On occasion, there are things which we simply won't need anymore. Our Betamax cassette might be a copy of something that we also hold in our collections. It might be a copy of an open reel tape. So if I migrate one of those to a stable digital file, do I need my interim Betamax cassette taking up space on shelf and costing real estate and all that, needing equipment to support it? No, I don't, I'd say. And that eventually might be disposed of in some way. Okay? Good. Thank you very much. Next up, digital music curator of note, Alex Wilson, is going to talk to you about digital downloads into the BL.